This is the BBC World Service. Now, the interview.
Hello and welcome. I'm Carrie Gracie. My guest today says humans are the sexiest of species. And rather by accident, he himself sparked a sexual revolution in his youth by developing the contraceptive pill. Half a century later, and this time by design, he's promoting a second and arguably more sweeping revolution, this time to separate sex from reproduction. Carl Gerassi, welcome to the interview.
Thank you.
Now, you've been in your time a chemist, an industrialist, a novelist, an ethicist, a playwright, an art collector, all of which I want to come to. But I want to begin with your ideas on reproduction. You have a vision of a 21st century in which we have reproduction without sex and sex without reproduction. You made the second part possible 50 years ago by inventing the contraceptive pill, but reproduction without sex? Explain.
Well, first of all, you make it sound as if I want to promote this. I'm simply an observer and pointing out that's what we're already doing and that it's inevitable. In 1977, you had a revolution right here in England when Edwards and Steptoe invented IVF, in vitro fertilization, that is, reproduction without sex. Now, that, of course, was done for people who could not have children under ordinary circumstances. There were 2 million such children or persons now living in this world. The thing that I am positing is in the future, fertile people, not just infertile people, will use that as a possible option. I'm not saying that everyone will do this, but more and more of them, and most of them will be women.
But why would they?
Because lots of things have changed in women's lives. In other words, the ideal time to have a child is in your 20s, in fact, even earlier than that. Many women now, as they're moving into occupations, educational careers, they wait until the middle or late 30s and suddenly discover that there are difficulties, infertility, higher incidence of genetic malformations, and so on. These are women who will suddenly look at the type of thing that I'm mentioning as a possible option, because one thing that you do in this in vitro fertilization, you have an embryo outside the body, a 16-cell embryo. Only then you're transferred in the woman, then you have a natural pregnancy.
So you're saying that women in their late teens even would say to themselves, well, if I want to go to university and have a career, I might as well have some eggs removed now at the point where they're at their healthiest, and I'll reproduce using those removed eggs later on.
I didn't say that yet. That was my second statement, and I thank you for anticipating it. That would be the other reason. That we cannot quite do yet, certainly not well yet. It has been done a few times, namely to put your young eggs or young ovarian cells into the bank, so to speak, and then check them out when you want them. There's no question that that will happen within the next 10 years or so. What I'm positing is the first one, which already you can do now, namely, you use standard in vitro fertilization, but you analyze the embryo genetically by methods that one did not have before. The ability to do that, rather than what these women have to do now, have an amniocentesis, a genetic analysis when they're 3 months pregnant. This way, you can do it way before, and you have that choice. There's one other thing you might as well face, if one really can do that, namely, store your eggs and put them in the bank, and of course, men already can store their sperm for years and decades, then why not get sterilized rather than practice contraception?
It's quite an enormous idea to get one's head around what you're actually positing as an inevitability for the future. Is it culturally acceptable, even if it's technically possible?
Well, I, of course, disagree with you completely. It's just we are hypocrites. We pretend that this is terrible or awful or
I didn't
you
say
name
it was terrible.
No,
I just
you
said
didn't.
It was big
Excuse
idea.
Me. You didn't, but many people do, particularly the fundamentalists in the United States, of which we have more and more of them. But that's a very different proposition. What they're forgetting is that they're doing it all the time anyway. We really, the separation of sex and reproduction is with us. The incremental step is only this business of having the few times when you want to reproduce it, you do it without sex. At least consider the possibility of doing it. Remember, this is all basically an insurance system. What we're trying to do is extend the biological clock by maybe 5 or 10 years, not making 60-year-old mothers first time, but to extend that biological clock, I think, is an enormous advantage for hundreds of thousands of women, if not millions of women, an option.
But where does it stop? I mean, you say not to have 60-year-old mothers, but
quite frankly,
are you going to be able to stop that? Are you going to be able to stop people having the biological children of dead people.
Well, what does anyone have a right to tell me, and I don't mean me, Carl Gerasse, what I want to do? I think in the end, that cannot be legislated. You know, the highest incidence of illegal abortions right now in the world is in all Catholic Latin American countries. The lowest birth rate in Europe, and they're all Catholic Italy and Spain. I shouldn't just use the Catholic religion, you have it in others as well, but the fact of the matter is people make, in the end, personal decisions. They ought to be well educated for this, and that, in fact, is what I have taken as my personal mission. I want to tell people what the facts are so they can make more reasonable decisions on their own.
But there are facts about the human psyche as well, presumably. Just to mention the pill for a moment, if you look at the experience of the last 50 years, you developed it 50 years ago, and it's still profoundly unacceptable in many societies today. Is it a problem, then, to adjust to these new technical developments?
Well, I can't buy any of your arguments, I have to tell you right away. I mean, if you think of the difference in behavior, let's say, between the 1950s and just the late 1960s and early 1970s, or the difference between the 1970s and the year 2000, these are dramatic changes. I'm not saying that they're good changes. In fact, some of them are really quite bad ones. The fact of the matter is this is cultural, and you cannot at all predict what will happen in the future, or for that matter, what is good and what is bad.
And yet, many people still have not just the religious people you were mentioning a moment ago, but many people of a secular frame of mind still have some kind of family ideal of parents, children produced through sexual encounter, through some kind of sacred, holy moment.
Excuse me, that's true of me too. You know, I am a firm believer in the family, and I think it is utter nonsense to believe that the separation is going to destruction of the nuclear family. I think it's just the other way around. I can make a very persuasive case that it will strengthen the nuclear
family. Oh, really?
Let's
hear it.
Well, it's very simple. There are about 1 million children born, conception happen every 24 hours. So these, about half of them are unexpected, about half of those are unwanted. That's about 250,000 a day. Of these, we have about 150,000 illegal abortions every 24 hours. So therefore, I would say there are lots of unplanned, unwanted children. In that future that I described to you, every child will be a wanted child. A wanted child is usually a love child. A child is a cement for a relationship, usually a heterosexual relationship. It doesn't have to be, but most of the time it is. So therefore, you have indeed a child, a father and a mother. This will keep them together because they wanted to have that child, usually together. I see no reason to question, therefore, the validity, the importance of a nuclear family where the father will play more than just a genetic role. He should also be a parenting father, a partner, a participant.
And yet, I mean, many would say that it's hard to take the choice to have a child, and that some of the happiest families, most loving families, are actually the products of an accident.
But remember, I'm talking about options. If people would like to just practice reproduction by accident, they should do so. I'm just talking about those who do not want to do it the accident way, if you want to call it that.
Getting back to the religious position, because many of our listeners will say, what you are saying does not accord with my faith. My faith tells me that the business of sex and the business of reproduction are intimately connected and cannot be disentangled and should not be disentangled.
Well, I don't know what the evidence is that it cannot and should not be. But I would say I respect completely the religious beliefs of other people, and I under no condition want to dissuade them. What I object to is that they want to force their beliefs on me. I mean, I would say many of these same people that you're talking about believe that condoms cannot be used. Well, that's their privilege to tell every African who may be suffering from AIDS that he or she cannot use condoms and therefore should be sentenced to a sexless life or to a horrible life of perpetuating that disease and spreading it all over. Well, I think it's obscene, quite frankly. That's my opinion.
What about some of the potential pitfalls or problems of what you're positing? These choices, these options that we're going to have, are we going to have too many of them? Not just to have children in our old age, not just to have children who bear no genetic relation to ourselves, not just to have the children of dead people, if we like, but also to select gender, to select height, to select aptitude?
Well, of course, now you're talking about a very slippery slope, and...
But this is the slope.
No, I understand it completely, and I don't question it at all, and I would be just as worried about it as you are, so I accept the last caveat that you mentioned entirely. But to in fact select for that, particularly for intelligence on, that's so far away that this is the sort of thing I'm not spending sleepless nights on. And I'm not talking about that modification. I think it would be terrible, in fact. I'm talking about the prevention of things that can be prevented. For instance, we can screen, let us say, for a genetic predisposition for cancer. And you have six embryos, you screen them, and one of them shows that mutant and the others do not. Which one are you going to select? If you say, no, I will not, I leave it up to chance, well, then leave it up to chance. That is your business. But why do I have to do this?
Is it good to have so many radical options? Couldn't you just be arguing for better contraception?
Well,
So that every child's a wanted child because we all have the opportunity to have decent contraception.
You know, I would love to make that argument. As a scientist, of course, I would say yes. But I also am realistic. The fact of the matter is that you have better forms, new method of contraception. The only way to introduce them is through the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry is not interested in that topic anymore. Of the 20 largest pharmaceutical companies in the world, only two of them are even peddling, I would say, oral contraception for women. Not a single one is working, of these 20, on male contraception. Not a single one is working on fundamentally new approaches to contraception. Why? Because they're focusing on the wealthy parts of the world. That's Europe, North America, and Japan. These are the geriatric countries of the world. They're interested in the diseases of aging deterioration, of Alzheimer's, cancer, and so on. They're not interested in contraception.
So no future there?
I would say no future in terms of radical changes, but I, on the other hand, also want to posit that we don't really necessarily need them because we can manage with the existing ones that we have.
And getting back to the cultural dimension of all of this, for thousands of years, societies have been worrying about female sexuality getting out of hand. They worried about chastity, they worried about monogamy for
the
women,
men,
at
the
least.
Men have
indeed.
Been worrying about this.
And and having, in the view of those with traditional opinions about sexuality, brought depravity and social breakdown with your contraceptive pill, here you are again threatening to liberate women further. Will they need men at all? Will men need women, other than for brief sexual transactions?
No, of course we need them. But I think we're talking about men.
Why will we?
Because I, as a man, you're looking at one right now, I think I have something to offer to a woman other than just what we do in bed for a short period of time.
And what is
as
that?
A partner. A true partner in life. Now, I would say this is the ultimate ideal. Sometimes it isn't just between man and woman, sometimes it's between two men and two women, and I think that's their business.
And in thinking all these unthinkables, do you make people angry?
But they're not unthinkable.
Well,
I make them angry,
clearly they're
course.
Thinkable, because here you are thinking
well,
them.
Of course I make them angry, but I also make them curious, and I think, frankly, this is why I give a lot of talks. This is sort of a writing I do now. Instead of sticking around in the laboratory, I've decided a fairly advanced age, I want to do something else. I want to become an intellectual smuggler. I want to smuggle these ideas into the minds of people who either don't want to listen to them, don't understand them, or are afraid of them. So instead of telling them, this is what I want, I say, come, read what I have to say. I want to amuse you. I want to take you to the theater. But then I contaminate them.
You're 82. Why not leave all these dangerous ideas alone?
I'm only 82 chronologically. You know, I've started some new intellectual lives. I became a playwright 8 years ago, a novelist about 15 years ago. So I'm a youngish novelist and a very young playwright.
Someone suggested to me that your urge to separate sex from reproduction might stem from an episode in your childhood when a syphilitic patient led to the postponement of your bar mitzvah by your father. Now, that does not immediately make sense as a theory to me, but does it to you?
Well, I'm impressed by your research. It's the first time I've heard this hypothesis. It's just an amusing one. My father was a specialist in venereal diseases. This was now in the 1930s. He was in Bulgaria at that time. I was in Vienna. My parents were divorced. My father was supposed to come on a certain date to that bar mitzvah ceremony, and he couldn't make it. But I don't think that had a major impact on me.
And not related to these radical
absolutely
ideas that you're
not
espousing
absolutely
now?
Absolutely not.
You're listening to The Interview in the BBC World Service with me, Carrie Gracie, and my guest today, Carl Gerassi. Carl, are you proud of the pill?
Of course. Absolutely, unequivocally.
Why?
Well, because it has made an enormous difference, not just for women, but in a way in the relationships of men and women. The power relationship between men and women has always been that men have been way on top and women on the bottom in the context of deciding whether and when a woman should get pregnant, even when to initiate sexual intercourse, the consequences of it. I think that has changed. These rules of games have changed. Some men have felt threatened by this, weakened by this, and I think it's all to the good, because I think that power relationship has to change. And that it has done, and it's done it on the whole in a very positive way. Now, there are negative aspects to it, no question whatsoever, but there are negative aspects to everything, to childbearing and skiing and going to the movies and listening to music and listening to the BBC.
Oh,
that? Sure, if you listen too much to it, yes.
And has it had an impact on your life? I mean, you've said it's had an impact on women everywhere and thereafter on their relationships,
well,
and
yes,
the men
and no.
in their lives. What about you?
Yes and no. That is, the no is in my reproductive life, because my reproductive life really occurred before the discovery of the pill. So in that context, I would say no. In the yes context, yes. It has made me aware that the scientific issues are really not the important ones, the social issues, the cultural, the religious, the legal ones. And I've moved into that direction, policy decisions.
So it's moved you from being a narrow chemist into something else?
Yes. Really, I put it another way, from a hard scientist to a softer one.
And just on the subject of fertility and IVF and the preoccupations of the rich world, you once said the money it costs to produce one child for someone who wasn't meant to be a parent could maintain the lives of thousands of children in a poor country, children already born naturally. Is this you coming down against IVF, or do you sit on the fence on that one?
There, I was not so much talking about IVF. I was talking about the absolutely heroic things that we are doing in trying to keep alive children that are born much too early, and the attempts to try and push that frontier back and back. In other words, you know, a 24-week-old baby can be kept alive. And that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not $1 million, to keep one of these children alive compared to what you could do with children already born.
And so is this the kind of moral dilemma that you're writing about in your novels and your plays?
Well, in a way, right now, the newest play on which I'm going to finish in 2 weeks, which is called When Harriet Met Sally, you can see right away from the name, talking about two women. Well, I really want to say that words like that we just discussed, family, parenthood, baby, marriage, which were unambiguous black and white terms that no one even questioned because there was nothing to question, all of them are now destabilized, all of them are fuzzy, and for each of them you can create a horror scenario, a true horror scenario.
And so, Harriet Met Sally, is that a horror scenario?
No, it is not. It is a realistic scenario, it's a compassionate one, it's even an amusing one, but it is one that really will make people
about
think
lesbians.
In question. Well, it's not just lesbian. First of all, they've got to have a father. In this case, they're going to have a sperm donor. In each case, it's the brother of the other one. So you have suddenly a very complicated situation. Uncles, biological fathers, sperm donors, the parents happen to be two women. What does parenting mean? Does parenting have to be always genetic, or is it really love, attention, focus on upbringing? I mean, there are so many aspects of it.
And do you have a message with these stories, or is it to challenge the preconceptions and fixed sense of the world
it
that we
without,
try to hang on
is
to?
Without question, the latter. I do not preach. I do not give them my opinion. I do not give them black and white answers. I want the audience to decide for themselves what is, quote, the right answer, because there is no right answer. These are all gray questions. We have this pathetic desire to have black and white answers to gray questions. You're only going to get gray answers to them.
And you call it science in fiction, but don't we have enough science in real life? Do we need it in fiction?
I'm talking about knowledge, and I think the knowledge is abysmal. I think the gulf between the scientific community and the rest of the world is broadening. Scientists are doing very little about it. The rest of the world is doing very little about it. But I, incidentally, do not want to just teach them about science. I really want to much more talk about the behavior and culture of science.
But it's not, I know you've talked about your writing as a kind of interpreting of this strange tribe, the scientific community, but it seems to me that it's more than that. It's more teasing out the incredible implications of the work that's been done and examining some of the ethical, practical, emotional, cultural dilemmas that will ensue.
Well, it is that. But I really am also talking about the tribal culture of scientists and really urge us to be more us, the scientists, be more self-reflective, to turn the mirror around, look into the mirror itself, wash dirty lab coats in public, so to speak, because I really do believe we should do that.
Point being that scientists are no more godly than the rest of us.
Absolutely. We're human beings.
With all the foibles.
Yes, but also some qualities that most people don't know.
And other than being a strange zoo species, does it matter to us that they're peculiar? I mean, it doesn't have implications for me, are my listeners, that they are peculiar scientists.
Of course it does, because, you know, those are the people who have changed the world in the last 100 years much more than anyone else. Almost any change in your life you can reduce to scientific and then technological advances, good or bad. So the answer is yes. Might as well find out what that peculiar tribe is doing and why they're doing it. What's driving them?
Well,
it's very simple. It's ambition. I mean, many scientists will object to that, but I would say their nourishment is ambition, but their poison is also the ambition. And I'm really talking about that balance of poison and nourishment.
What are they ambitious for?
Well, it's name recognition, of course, to try to be first in a very absurd, almost pathetic way.
It's ego.
Well, it's totally ego. No wonder that one of my plays is called Ego. I admit to this terrible disease, in a way. Well, it's not even terrible. I admit to that disease because it has its positive features, of course, as well. It's very self-gratifying. But one other thing that we do, we happily, or not so happily, work 80 hours a week for decades. That's not money. You cannot possibly pay for that. It's a drive to satisfy your curiosity, which is fantastic. That is why I call myself an intellectual polygamist, whereas most scientists are entire intellectual monogamists. And while monogamy is fine in marriage, I think intellectually it's bad.
Let's go for a moment of introspection. What drives your ambition? Where does it come from? Is it from being a refugee at such a young age?
Probably, yeah. It's the rootlessness. You want to diversify. You don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. Having had it once and having lost that basket, so to speak, you never quite regain that security of having a home and an ambiance that fits you.
And do you ever get up in the morning and think, oh, I don't seem to feel ambitious today?
No, not yet. I'm too young for that.
And do you ever go back to Vienna?
Yes, now I do actually quite frequently. The last 10 years or so, I give a lot of lectures. I go there for book launches, theater premieres, and so on. And culturally, I dare say I'm a European. I really recognize that now my original education in Vienna during my first 14 years was a superb one, which we hardly replicate these days. You know, at age 14, I already had 4 years of Latin. Well, you know, you can't do that in the United States even if you want to. I had the great advantage of living during a non-TV age. I was reading instead of being a couch potato. I didn't know about cars until I was an adult.
And another aspect of your intellectual polygamy is that you're such a big art collector. Paul Klee, you've got one of the biggest collections of Paul Klee in the world. Does that tie you back into your roots as well?
It may, although art collecting, unfortunately, has to do with affluence, and I only became affluent when I really was already quite mature as a result, partly of the work on the pill. But art, you know, there's a good line in my latest play Well, the scientist asked the art historian, well, how necessary is art? She says, art is never necessary. It just happens to be indispensable. And I really believe that.
We talked about your age. You look very well. But am I allowed to ask you whether you think about death and whether you're afraid of death?
Oh, I'm not afraid of death because I certainly realize that I'm going to be dying. But you put your finger on it, and at age 1985, at age 63, I was on my way going trekking in the Himalayas, and instead was diagnosed having cancer. Ended up the day after in a hospital and did not really know whether I'd survive it. At that time, I never worried about it, but I wouldn't die tomorrow and in 5 years and 10 years sometimes, mañana. Well, now I do worry about this. Worry about it not in the context being afraid of it, but this preoccupation, I don't have enough time to do the things I still want to do, that causes me to work, do things 7 days a week. And again, I'm again that workaholic that I wanted to get away from. The scientific workaholic.
And you do want to get away from it. I mean, you have published thousands of articles, the plays, the novels, you've got the art collection, you've got the reputation. What are you still in such a hurry to do?
Well, of course, you're completely right in a way. And yet, right now, I'm a playwright. And I basically write a play a year. And there's no question that each play gets better, in my opinion. And I'm now really a very different playwright from the one I was 7 years ago, because I've now written six plays.
And does it matter that other people think that they're getting better, that other people love them? Does it matter that they're performed, or do you write it, firstly, for your own pleasure and gratification?
Again, I'm embarrassed to admit that the answer is no, not for that. For me, a play is a play only if it gets performed, or if people have read it in book form or something like that. I'm very ambitious along these lines. But it's equivalent to your saying, are you willing to be the first to climb Everest or some other unclimbed peak and then not tell anyone? No, I'd like to have my picture taken while I'm on top of that. I'm that sort of a mountain climber.
And when people write lists of the most important individuals of the past century or even the past millennium, your name often comes up on those lists. Does that matter?
Well, that, I think, in many respects, is utter nonsense, because what woman would really care who had made the synthesized the first oral contraceptive? In fact, has any idea who that is? It's totally unimportant. It's a very different question is who wrote Hamlet, you know, who composed this and that piece of music and so on. It would not have been composed if that person had not lived. There's no question if I had not lived, someone else would have done this. If Newton hadn't lived, someone else would have.
So 50 years of chemistry didn't make you immortal, but the 20 years of writing plays may make you immortal.
Well, I'll leave it up to others to decide that, but theoretically that is much more possible, yes.
Carl Gerassi, thank you very much for joining us on the interview.
Carrie Gracie was talking to Carl Gerassi. The programme was produced by Joe Glanville. This is the BBC World Service.